what's
happy
the
Easter?
Happy, happy, yeah, well, I guess almost.
But early.
Yeah, but early, early on here. we're getting ready. Horsemen starting to trickle downstairs as the National HBPA convention that was supposed to come here last year and, of course, was postponed. They were, you know, they were eager to follow through on coming to Oaklawn, and it did give them the opportunity to utilize the hotel. And so from that standpoint, I think, and we'll talk to Dr. Daniels, we'll talk to Eric Hamelbeck, and then tons of guests as the morning unfolds, as the next 3 days unfold. And of course, Friday, we've got a very busy handicapping session when it comes to New York, California, and Florida. We talked about it a little bit earlier this morning, or earlier yesterday, Hammer and I, and Rick with us. We'll have, among others, I know Dick Powell. Dick actually got here very late. He had a huge delay in Chicago, 10 hours he had to sit in Chicago.
He had to go from Hong Kong to Chicago.
Well, not from Hong Kong. He came over from from Albany, but he got very delayed, and I guess they got stuck in Albany, and an hour and a half later, they finally got going, and he missed the connection. Anyway, so he got here very late. So we'll talk to Dick in the second half hour, and we've got to check in with Sid. I do want to check in with Sid and get some Sire Watch Better Refocus brought to you by Hill and Dale Inn, and actually going to... You know, it's a strange scenario. If we talk about what went on here with Sid, you've got the two stallions that passed, Leoban and Arrogate. A very unusual circumstance in that regard. So we'll talk to Sid. And Sid also, we got to give him a chance to plug his fiction piece that was published. And in a very august... literary magazine, very nice. That Sid is a man.
He's a man for all seasons.
Yes, yes, exactly. Later, I'm going to look forward to Pat Cummings coming down. Pat is on hand from Thoroughbred Idea Foundation. We'll talk to Pat, but we'll also reach out at the same time and bring in Adam Koenig from Kentucky, because Adam has introduced the legislation like we talked a few months ago. We talked a few months ago about the potential to introduce legislation that would bring breakage down to the penny. And Adam has introduced it. And, of course, Adam has been a big, a huge proponent, supporter, you name it. He's been incredibly supportive of the racing industry, and being that he's from Turfway, he's from Florence. That's his district, and well, so gaming issues very much in the forefront for his agenda.
I think some of the listeners who don't quite know what breakage is, you hear that term around, are going to learn a lot from these two guys. Right?
Yeah, well, I mean, Pat, ever since Pat wrote the white paper about breakage and the idea of trying to pick up the lead that Steve Crist started 25 years ago, literally, when they got New York to move from a dime to a nickel, that was progress. This could be a domino theory scenario, and to have Kentucky, to have a place like Kentucky go to penny breakage will be could very well start a trend. So
Let's hope it gets the ball rolling. Let's explain exactly where we are here on the property. We mentioned, it's the racing casino and resort. We're in the event center, which is kind of in the middle of all three of those things. It's everything's connected. You can go from here and be in the casino in a few minutes and down the street and go in the hotel and right around the corner. In the building is the racetrack. So quite a quite a nice entertainment center they've built here at Oaklawn. This is probably the first Horseman's event that's been held here. And you mentioned the holdover from last year, the HPPA convention. I don't think we could have done it last year here.
No, that was one of the benefits of
right.
the delay.
So
not, the hotel was going to be done.
Not only was the hotel done, the event center's done. See that stuff outside called sunshine? I'm not sure we could have done that either. But it's great to have you here. You know, for myself, who has been racing on many coasts and been to many conventions, and that's my got to have water. This is new territory for me, as far as meeting new people. You go to different conferences, you shake a lot of hands, and a lot of times you see the same people. And, I had to ask, who comes to these conventions? Is this horsemen or is it regulators or whatever? So we went to the opening cocktail party last night, and, it always amazed me. Sometimes you think you know a lot of people, and I went in and, man, I don't know a whole lot of these people. And then you walk around, you see the name tags, and we both go, I know you. I never met you, but I know you. And so
exactly.
it's always a welcoming opening when you go see people and meet new people here at these conventions. And I'm glad to be here, and we're on a panel today to talk about a few things. But we're going to have some interesting guests this morning, and we're starting off real quick here.
Well, and one of the traditions in the coverage we've done the last 5 years or so, maybe six, has included kind of the invocation, as it were, between Eric Hamelbeck and the past presidents and anybody that has been among the leadership at HBPA. And Dr. Daniels joins us, Doug Daniels, of course. And Dr. Daniels, welcome. Thanks so much for coming down and getting started.
Thanks for having me be a part of it. Appreciate it very much.
Not at all. And, obviously, and I'm going to get Eric's input as well. The HBPA, I'd love to start and talk about any number of topics, but given the lawsuit, with HISA, that is going to be on a lot of people's agenda and a lot of people's minds. So that a topic that we'll explore as we wait for the court to basically, hear the case. But for you, talk about your getting involved at this level and helping run the National HBPA.
Well, I'm a horse vet. And I grew up with horse racing. I went to the races in Nebraska with my parents from a very young age. Enjoyed the races at Exarban and Fauner Park and Attica and Columbus, Lincoln. My parents raced horses in the Midwest throughout my childhood. So it was in me. And as I say, I went to vet school to work on horses. And have enjoyed a very rewarding career. And this wasn't a position I took lightly, for certain. I discussed it at great length with my family before I took it on, and it's one I am enjoying very much. The upper members of the National HBPA have been very inviting and very helpful. Leroy Gessman and Rick Hiles and the rest have all been very helpful and have reached out to me with a helping hand whenever necessary, and I've very much appreciated it. I want to say that. I had the same revelation last night at the cocktail party too, that there are so many people that I have missed and didn't know it. And we as horsemen have missed our opportunity to get together and I think that's important. And I think we all appreciate that now that we are back together, that this is something we've missed. And I'm glad that we're here. I woke up this morning and my hotel room looks out onto the clubhouse turn here at Oaklawn Park, and it was just, I've literally waited for it to get light enough for the horses to come out and train so I could watch them. And it's just a great venue, and we really thank the Arkansas HBPA for sponsoring us, hosting us in this venue, for certain.
Real quick, you called it the clubhouse turn. The other day, in one of Vic Stauffer's calls, he called it the hotel turn.
And apropos.
I think that might stick.
Oh,
it was pretty good.
Good.
Everybody lifted their head and went, Wow, that's pretty good.
The hotel tour. Yeah, well, it's all that for certain. It's all that. I enjoyed it.
You know, you came out of the Virginia, right? Out of the Virginia HBPA.
Correct. Yeah.
In fact, we had Debbie Easter yesterday, Monday, talking, you know, getting kind of an official response to the prospects of Churchill buying Colonial. And for you, and it's interesting, you mentioned Leroy out of Arizona. For you, as a vet and with your background, it feels like a opportune scenario to have someone with your credentials that obviously understands medication. You know, that it feels like this is the principal concern right now industry-wide, and so to have that kind of a background is invaluable.
And I think I used that same term when I accepted this position. It's an opportune time for a veterinarian with a voice to be in this position with HISA coming on board, it appears, and with the various medication problems. And clearly what's happening in Arizona is tragic, and I think it deserves all of our attention, and I think it's something that is going to get that attention and hopefully improve.
What are your, you know, what are your, I don't want to call them talking points, but what are your principal, you know, top line concerns and how the national HBPA can affect positive change and influence?
I think having realistic and science-based thresholds for our accepted therapeutic medications is absolutely mandatory. It has to be something that, not a number that somebody pulled out of a book or has extrapolated from another species. It has to be something that has been studied and has a foundation. And I think, you know, that's where I hope to have an impact. I've interacted with Dr. Finger and Dr. Tobin quite a lot on this and attended some RMTC meetings and tried to voice my opinion as well as I could. And, you know, that's a forum that I feel comfortable in. And, you know, as I say, I'm a horse vet and I spend all day driving around in a truck and I'm happy talking to people about their horses and what the problem is and what we can do about it. And getting in that forum with the RMTC at a table with 10 or 12 people that really want to know what I have to say about medication issues and listen is something I'm very comfortable with. This thing this morning I'm going to do in front of 140 or 50 people is something that I've been sort of rehearsing in my hotel room. but it is something I'm enjoying, and that's a facet of this position that I feel like I can continue to improve upon.
Who do you trust, essentially? Who do you feel the industry should be relying on? You mentioned RMTC. There's a lot of critique about the threshold levels and the testing that established the thresholds. Does this area, is it an area that needs overhaul, complete reevaluation?
I don't really think that. I feel like in a lot of ways the medication, we have a framework of medication regulations that between the ARCA and the RMTC has come up with that we just, as a whole, outside of the Mid-Atlantic, have not been able to adopt by all the racing jurisdictions. And I think that is something that we need to look at and think about and consider. And, you know, we hear all the time this patchwork of medication regulations and so on, and it really isn't that at all. It's not that every state has their own regs and rules and adjudication. So it is something that I think that's something we need to explore in including or in lieu of the HISA medications. Who to trust and who to listen to, that's a tough one. Everybody has an opinion.
How do you suggest the stakeholder community, owners, breeders, horse players, fans, how do you suggest they view some of the topics that are more or less central and at the same time, you know, tangential to a lot of the discussions going on? Specifically, things like out of competition testing, mm-hmm. things like what is being identified as you know, products used influence performance that are undetectable. Where do we go on this, Doc?
You have to realize that they're doing these things for a reason. You know, it's sadly enough, it's something that the industry has brought upon itself, and the players in the industry have brought upon itself. But I want to think that this doesn't have to be an all or nothing thing, from a standpoint of the HISA regulations or other facets of the medication regs. It doesn't have to be all or nothing. It can be something we can come together on and not just say, okay, what they say is the way it is. It's something we can massage. And I think it is something we can include needs work. And it's something that if HISA comes about as they are predicting or not, this is clearly the impetus that we needed for that change.
So you mentioned something a little bit ago about the different rules in different states, mm-hmm. and they aren't different. You mentioned application of the rules. Now, Steve and I are on a panel later this afternoon about how we can better get the message across in a better way, so our horse players and our fans understand what's going on. You have so many different facets of the game. When it comes to medication, are you guys looking for a way to make this easier to take care of? So when you explain something like this to the layperson out there that's trying to understand the drugs and the way we do it and the way we adjudicate it, it seems like every state's different, and you're saying it's not. Is there a way that we can get this all on one page, and when we try to explain it to the fans and our horse players and our stakeholders, that everybody's understanding the same thing?
The Mid-Atlantic Coalition has been under the same rules and abiding by the same recommendations for a number of years now, and it's something that's been successful for us, and we're proud of it. And, you know, I think in some ways, this is just Daniel's opinion. Some of the other racing jurisdictions that have opted to not be on board with more uniform testing and regulations, I think they need to get on board. I think that it's something that we need from a regulatory standpoint to say, okay, this is a set of rules that has worked for the Mid-Atlantic, and maybe we could change those somewhat as well, but it doesn't have to be federally regulated. It does not have to be. And I think in some ways, again, I'll say we've brought this upon ourselves. But I'm from a standpoint of patchwork rules and regulations, that's a talking point.
When you say on the federal side of things and having a body, an entity to further the uniformity, mm-hmm. there's been a lot of progress on model rules, but there's been aspects and pockets either of resistance in some cases, or then of course Florida is probably a terrific example, because here's a state that has a lot of racing and has a lot of important racing, and they really don't have a regulatory agency that is dedicated to the supervision of the game, and they were very close to introducing one, but that's an example of a place where I don't want to call them opponents, because people aren't, you know, everybody wants the best for the game on a widespread basis. But isn't that, as an example, a reason that uniformity via HISA makes sense?
In some ways, yes, I agree with that. I have some opposition to the way the HISA was formed,
of
and
course.
The folks behind it.
I do too.
But the idea of having some regulatory body having oversight of all of racing in North America, in the United States, I think is important. I think it's something we can all agree with, and I think there are certain aspects of HISA that we all we're all behind. I'm very unhappy that our opponents in the HISA matter, whether it's the folks at the Humane Society of the United States or whoever, they have done a much better job in putting their message out and saying, you know, we're all a bunch of dopers, and calling these medication positives for, again, accepted therapeutic medications that were slightly over a threshold limit. And again, things that all athletes require and use judiciously, but they'd lump them all into the same category of we're doping them, we're drugging them to race them, and that's just not true. But they've done an excellent job in putting that false message out there.
Well, we've also got a problem just in terms of the constant drumbeat on two tracks. You've got the ongoing prosecutions involved with the federal indictments.
Yep.
The Jason Service trials has been pushed back to 2023. Mm-hmm. So you're looking at another calendar year of this topic being out and on a regular basis, you know, presented to the public, and just in terms of reportage, not even necessarily of anybody, you know, trying to embarrass the industry. But then at the same time, you've got a situation like the Medina Spirit Baffert Derby overage and you know, the presence of the betamethasone, whether it came from treatment or whether it came from inadvertent use of the Automax, it doesn't matter. So you've got the really a parallel set of trains that are just in the news cycle and in the, you know, in the public eye, just on a near daily basis. Certainly the Baffert thing is on a daily basis, it seems. So it makes it look like both the undetectable side, as well as, you know, the inadvertent overages of therapeutic meds that we just can't manage it. Not that HISA or whatever testing testing agency that is going to be involved ultimately, potentially, not that they're going to necessarily solve either of those problems magically, because they're not going to.
I think it is a matter of twofold. And one is establishing reasonable thresholds for those therapeutic medications. And in the Baffert medication issue, you know, the filly that he had Hox injected
Gamine, yep.
2 weeks before,
yep.
or 16 days or whatever it was,
yep.
should have been fine. It should have yep. been fine. And it wasn't. So, again, establishing reasonable therapeutic thresholds. The other horse that had the lidocaine positive, if it were the international regulations, one of them wouldn't have even been a positive.
Right.
There were two of them.
Right.
I think that's to start with. The flip side of that is the things that can't be detected. You know, go back to USADA and how they caught Lance Armstrong. It wasn't because he tested positive for anything. It's because they did great detective work, and they had somebody outed him. And I think that is more that should be a bigger deal in going forward, whether it's HISA or someone else, in not in super regulating everything we can find in the horse through blood or hair or whatever, but really doing better investigative work and doing better. Feet on the ground, you know, eyes on the horses.
I'm going to go back to the message prospect that we're talking about. You mentioned labeling. Mm-hmm. I've been in this game a long time. I'm not that familiar with medications. Mm-hmm. The longer the medication, the worse it is. I mean, and, you know, the longer, you know what I'm saying? And I think that's mm-hmm. what we do. Every quote overage is a felony out there, you know, comparatively. Mm-hmm. Can we do a better job of letting people know that this group is therapeutic and this group is a bad one, you know, or some red. This is a red violation. This is a brown violation. I don't know what it takes, but whenever you hear the word overage, it could be, you know, he took an extra aspirin. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, what's going on here? So there may be a better way to break that down for the horse player, for the average guy that's listening, to let them know that, you know, one's not the same as the other.
I think it's too complicated.
It is too complicated.
I think the RMTC has, you know, when they say this is a class 4C or class 4B or 4D or whatever, 3A, I got to look it up. I don't remember which one is which. I know the top ones are the bad ones, and the lower ones are therapeutics.
Right, A's and B's.
Yeah, A's and
not
B's
good.
Are bad. Yeah, C is pretty sketchy. D is those are our accepted therapeutic medications that largely fell beyond a threshold level, and Clara Finger beats this drum to death, and I praise her for it. But accepting or standardizing and establishing reasonable scientific threshold values for things that have very little potential for affecting race outcome,
right,
or enhancing their performance. I just every one of those is just a black eye for horse racing that we don't need, and it's ill understood. And again, it goes back to our opponents have just done a much better job in getting that ridiculous fallacy, that false message out there.
Well, and there's been any number of falsehoods and concepts that have been essentially thrown in the face of of domestic horsemen. Nowhere in the rest of the world do they use the. Also nowhere else in the world do they test like we do. It's just laughable. Even on the Lasix front, when the necropsy of Medina Spirit came out, and you had some people say he was working out on Lasix. It's like what are you talking about? Every horse in Europe, when they work seriously,
train on
Lasix. I mean, to be honest, there's one entity that has villainized an inexpensive, effective medication that prevents the. Yeah, the bleeding.
It's effective. It's transparent.
It's unbelievable.
It's not something that we hide. It's something that is effective and has no ill effects on the horse.
Actually, I'll ask you that as a vet. Dr. Daniels is with us. Doug Daniels, of course, who's president and chairman of the HBPA. And talk about the dehydration aspect.
Yeah.
And Kenny McPeak, who no one's going to question Kenny's Kenny's bona fides as a horseman. But Kenny has for a long time talked about that mm-hmm. the hydration factor and the leaching of fluids from the horse. From your experience, electrolytes and giving jugs,
trainers have compensated that forever.
Yeah.
They realize that if that is a potential side effect of the anti-bleeder medication Lasix, they compensate for it pre-race, post-race. I'm fearful of how some trainers are going to try and develop that state of dehydration that they perceive is happening when Lasix is gone. I'm fearful. I don't know. I think it's just a tragedy that we're even having this conversation. So, I think Lasix is not just safe and effective, but it's harmless, and I think it's necessary in for many horses. And I'm very sad about the prospects of our industry losing that medication.
Well, considering that everyone involved professes their love of the horse mm-hmm. and the care and attentiveness to the well-being of the horse, let's take away something that prevents a problem. It doesn't make any sense.
They've been riding that masked train for so long.
Well, that topic, I mean, that it's amazing that has not been put to bed. Do you want to address that? The incredible, it's a topic that won't go away.
It can mask everything.
It's been proven repeatedly.
It's fallacy again.
Exactly, fallacy. That it masks other things in the blood.
And in the show horse world, there was a time where, and it might still even be doing it, where if they couldn't get a urine sample in a horse that came out of the ring, they would administer Lasix to obtain urine. So it has no masking properties that we can't see through at this point. None.
Well, it, talk about the changes in. You talked about hair follicles earlier. Mm-hmm. It's not as if you know, the urine. I mean, there's so many other ways to test a horse than there were, you know, 30 years ago.
Yep.
Explain those differences and those layers.
Well, yes, I know just a minuscule amount about some of the other testing methods, but let it be said that the administration of Lasix is not going to hide other products, other things that are performance enhancing that trainers are administering in a way to gain advantage. It's just not. It is again another false narrative that's been pushed and has been disproven repeatedly.
How do we get past that? How do we get in the position we're in? Then
you know, I sat still and listened to a subcommittee panel discussion in D.C. probably 2 years ago now. And one of the folks on the panel was a very well-known retired jockey. And he, in one sentence, said how terrible he took Lasix to try and cut weight as a jockey and how terrible it made him feel. Terrible. And then in the very next sentence, he said they tried to profess that Lasix, through its dehydrating properties, wasn't a performance enhancer. And to me, those two ideas don't go together. They don't make you feel terrible and make an enhanced performance. And that was, nobody even questioned that particular panelist on the point he was trying to make.
Well, maybe not in the committee, but certainly, it was scoffed at in these quarters. Going beyond the medication issues, what other topics that you know, you've obviously had to come up to speed? Frank Angst, you've obviously had, I'm sure there's been areas, Dr. Daniels, that have been new to you, right? That
absolutely
you've had to catch up on.
Yeah, the HCP visa thing that Eric spends a lot of time working on is something that's still fairly foreign to me. And, you know, I just want to say, I'll be very frank and honest in saying that, you know, I was a good student. I've got early admission to vet school. I graduated with honors. I have a successful practice with multiple associates in Virginia. This job on a daily basis makes me feel pretty stupid. Pretty stupid. I mean, Eric has so many irons in the fire and keeps track of so many topics and remembers so many people. And half the time, he'll get halfway through something he's discussing with me, and I'll say, start over and tell me, who's that person again? Because I've forgotten. You know, he has so many people in his repertoire and of contacts, and I just don't know how he does it, truly. Again, this job is humbling.
Well, you mentioned the labor issue. You know, there's also a topic that cropped up that I don't think anybody, let's say 3 years ago, was aware of. That was, and it was in New York that we've seen the labor department basically assail the horsemen on the manner in which they compensate, and not that New York is part of the TRA, but the THA, but you know, those issues, I mean, those are the other things that, you know, that are intrinsic with a horseman's association, and, you know, the habits and practice, you know, this is a you know, an anachronistic entity. I mean, the training, care, and racing of horses is thousands of years old. You know, it's not a modern endeavor. So there's certain things that go on that, you know, that may have to be overhauled. I mean, is that a fair?
Oh, yeah. And as I say, I think there is a whole lot about HISA that we agree with as an organization, and we should. There's a whole lot about it. And that speaks to the question, the point that you're making is that there is some overhauling to be done, and I don't think any of us are denying it. And I think it's a question of the implementation, how we're going to do it. And as I said previously, I think some of our reservation is just how HISA was put together, and in many ways that's some of the foundation for the litigation that exists. So I don't think anybody is denying that we have some work to do. It's just a matter of how we're going to go about it. And I think, as I said again, I don't whether it's whether HISA comes to comes about or not in the way that it is set up. Clearly, it's the impetus for some change that's needed, and I think I just would rather have more veterinary oversight and horsemen's input and really put the brakes on what now isn't going to happen on the time schedule that they've already set.
Do you have a seat at the table with HISA and their board and their meetings and their committees? And
we have friends. Yeah, we have friends. A seat at the table, not exactly. No. No. There are very smart people that have input. I don't know how much input they have, or I wish I had a seat at the table. I think this is about as close as I can get. And I through our lobbyists, make a lot of noise, or as much noise as we can afford to make. And I think that, again, the medication regulations that will come about from HISA, or that are supposed to come out from HISA, are more than we need in some ways, and much less in others. And that is the establish of therapeutic thresholds, of medication thresholds for our therapeutic medications, and done in a scientific manner, double-blind studies, et cetera, something that we can all look at, not, you know, just a number that they have arrived at and say, oh, we have information to back it up, but they don't show it to us. I think that's tragic.
There's so many other areas that I could throw at you, and there is one question before I let you go. As a racetrack practitioner,
and I work on racehorses, but I'm not on the racetrack.
Not on the race, but you mm-hmm. you certainly mm-hmm. interfaced.
Yep.
Is there a practical solution of having on track dispensaries that essentially have, you know, everything that everything legal that would be on the truck of a vet? If Frank Stronach talked about this years ago, Hong Kong is probably the shining apothecary on the hill, as it were. Is it achievable? Is it practical?
At one time, I would have already stopped you and laughed and said, "That's ridiculous." No racetrack veterinarian, as an industry, that we're not going to agree to that. No way. At one time, I would have said that, and now, I mean, I think it's something that is on the table. It's something that we have to seriously consider. And again, it is something largely brought upon ourselves. And I think that both the racing industry and the racetrack veterinarians as a whole realize now that there are a lot of cards on the table, and I think that's one that should have to be we have to consider.
Well, I was working for the Stronach Group at the time Mr. Stronach came up with that. It was 10, 12 years ago ish,
at least, yeah.
And it came through one of the memos and talk about it, and when it was brought up, crickets.
Yeah,
like you said, it was like, are you kidding me? This will never right. happen, and it never did.
Yep.
But as we get a little closer, it probably makes a lot of sense.
Well, I mean, it's again because there were medications that were showing up in racehorses that shouldn't have ever been there, and they only got there through a number of ways. We've brought some of this on ourselves. So I can't deny it, and I think my colleagues can't deny it, and it's a matter of now going forward making reasonable decisions and regulations that don't restrict our ability to treat the athlete, but keep all of us safe, the horses, the horsemen, the jockeys, and I think there's some compromise to be made, and I think that we need to make some of those decisions for ourselves before they get entirely made for us.
Well, and that kind of brings you back to the doorstep of HISA and, you know, where things are going to go, either, you know, starting in July or not. So we'll watch from there. Is there another area that has bubbled to the surface that you didn't expect, Dr. Daniels, something that was a revelation to you so far in this role?
Geez, you're putting me on the spot now. The HPPA has their hands in so many things. The horsemen really don't recognize, realize, or even need to. But it's the legislative aspect of this job and the interaction with the folks on Capitol Hill is not something I ever realized. It was one of the first things I got involved with the HPPA before I took on this role. But that is something legislatively that I hadn't really encountered before and had no exposure to it, and it's something that I've enjoyed in the limited role that I've had.
How about signal negotiation with the racetracks?
Yeah. You know, the thing is that if we could standardize that across affiliates across the country, that would help many things. But, you know, those numbers are proprietary, and it's I don't know that it really helps us by keeping things in that way.
You mentioned if we could
standardize it, it would likely be a better soup for everybody.
Well, and which of course opens the door for my favorite saying over the years from LBJ: "Don't spit in the soup. We've all got to eat it."
Amen.
You mentioned your when you go to Washington, you not maybe not you personally, but your group. We have a new president of the NTRA coming in. We were lucky enough to have dinner with him a few times in the last couple months, Tom Rooney. And I think he has experience in Washington. I think talking to him and Keith, they're one of their main goals is to go to Washington as one entity, one group, speaking the same message and not having three or four different horsemen's groups going there. And so do you guys work with them, or do you plan on meeting with him and trying to get together and get that done?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's going to be necessary. And you know, Mr. Rooney is someone that Eric Hamelbeck knows fairly well and has a relationship with, and I think that ongoing legislative experience and our access to him should only be helpful to everyone's cause, truly. And I think it was an artful decision for the NTRA to make to choose Mr. Rooney to step in.
To have somebody like even available and interested in the job with his background, with his family background, with his interest in equine life. There was so many things about it that work. You know, but one thing that Hammer, that you were kind of alluding to, the problem in terms of a single voice is that there's if this is a 20 mule team, mm-hmm. there's
a chorus.
There's probably four mules that pull in one direction. Those five mules pull in a different direction. I mean, there's different. Not that their interests aren't aligned with the greater good of the game, but their personal financial business interests are diverse, and that's one of the issues that you've got here, that is in a modern era very difficult for the game. There was a period certainly where the racetracks were owned by horsemen and by sportsmen,
right?
And everybody was on the same page in that regard.
Yeah,
and that, you know, everyone is very critical of Churchill, but they're a stock. They're a corporation that has got shareholders that they're trying to not appease, but to please. Everybody has got a different, I don't want to say agenda, but they serve different masters.
I think we agree on more things than most people think. The different players, we agree on more things than they think. There's even with HISA, we agree with significant portions of it. from a standpoint of CDI, I know you had Debbie Easter on the show, and I don't disagree with the things that she said either. But I think, like most Virginians, we have some anxiety about what's to come, some anxiety, and hope Debbie's right, and she knows all the players very well. I think that HISA, no matter what we think of it, from a standpoint of its content, the fact that it has gotten this far and then generated so much emotion and energy, it's going to be, if not the change, it's going to be the reason for change that our industry is going to see. And I want our horsemen and our veterinarians and our scientific colleagues to have more input in the things that are giving horse racing an unnecessary black eye.
Well put. Really well put. Dr. Doug Daniels, president and chairman of the National HBPA, you picked a trying and challenging time to step into this role. So certainly supportive and you know, believe in the cause, and wishing, you know, the best for, you know, not just for you, but for everybody at every level of the game.
Amen.
It's here. A pleasure to, you know, it gives me more confidence when you know, I get to meet someone like you with the intelligence and the drive to get things
experience
done.
Experience.
And experience,
well,
correct.
Yeah.
Well, here's to going forward. Thanks for having me on.
Not at all. Dr. Doug Daniels, everybody, the new president and chairman of the National HBPA. Ed Martin is joining us as well. And yeah, Dick, you can take the stick too, because there we go. Everybody, Dick Powell, as I mentioned, with us as well. And Ed, Eric hailed me. When I saw you walk in, I said, we need to talk to Ed Martin. Ed Martin of RCI, good morning.
I just appeared out of nowhere.
Yeah, you did. You did.
You have that kind of pulse.
like a jack-in-the-box. You popped up. Dick Powell, good morning.
Steve, I'm looking for someone to set a pick for me on the free throw line of life.
You've been waiting here 15 minutes, and that was the delivery. That's not bad.
Tell me what song that's from.
Oh, I can't.
Got to be a country western song.
It's a Cheech and Chong, Basketball Jones.
Oh, basketball. Look at you. Look at you.
I'm ready to get into a little Cheech and Chong.
That's a little...
Just said Ed Martin.
I'm not going to beat him on 101. I just need a pick to get loose.
Go for a van ride.
Follow from there.
And jam one down. Ed.
Yes, sir.
I've touched base with you a few times as the HISA USADA Odyssey has rolled along. And in Arizona, I'm thinking about we had, you know, ripped from today's headlines topic. One of the things that I sensed with USADA dropping out of consideration in what their assigned role would be under HISA's administration, to me, it essentially opened the door for everybody to understand we've already got a testing and regulatory body that can do that job, and there's already even a financing system in place. It wasn't like we needed to add another layer. Where is RCI right now? And make the case that, you know, we've got all the tools necessary to satisfy whoever is concerned about the ongoing testing and you know, punishment levels and everything else.
Yeah. So let me just say this: we actually got to the point where we were looking forward to working with USADA. And we were disappointed when USADA and the HISA negotiations broke down. What I had said to Travis Tigert on numerous occasions before and after is, you know, there's different ways to put all this together. There's a considerable public investment that's already been made in testing and investigations, in hearing cases and prosecuting cases. The scheme that the HISA put out on their website would not really avail itself of that to the maximum degree. The cost on an industry that's already paying taxes and not to get the benefit of getting some of those taxes back in terms of services from the states could be enormous, depending on it. So it's a very tricky thing for HISA. The state racing commissions our concern is that this not turn into a mess. And there's been some missteps, I think, over the initial year of putting this together. We're hopeful that Lisa Lazarus is a fresh new face and somebody dealing with this. I know I've had a couple of really good conversations with her. This is not going to get implemented in a one-size-fits-all on a state-by-state basis. And what's happening is I think a lot of people in the racing industry, and what I said months ago is the longer this plays out, the longer this issue gets elevated to governor's offices, to budget directors, and so forth. And what they did is they passed a bill. They passed a bill, and they basically said to the states, you don't really have to do this anymore. We're going to do this. We're going to pay for it. You don't have to do it anymore. And state budget directors, if you leave a dime on the table, they'll try to take 15 cents off that table, okay? And that's what's happening now. And HISA needs to develop that balance with the states. The state racing commissions, you have to understand, are not part of the racing industry. They represent the public. The role of the states in getting involved in the regulation of any form of gambling, whether it's bingo, pull tab tickets, casinos, or horse racing, or human sports, is to provide a level of consumer protection to the public that what they're betting on is on the up and up. And the states are not going to get into sports betting like they do with horse racing. So what they did is they passed a bill that gives the states, the higher ups from the racing commissions, the ability to say, we're not going to do this anymore. So if you want our stewards to enforce your whip rule, you may have to pay a portion of our steward's salary. What that is, I don't know. If you want our regulatory veterinarian to do the pre-race exams that you want, well, maybe you have to hire the regulatory veterinarian. I don't want to drop a bomb and say this could be a mess, but it could be a mess. And I think we got to get everybody in the room and figure out. And the best advice I could give to HISA, and I've given it to HISA, is you need to start these individual state-by-state negotiations, get in the room and figure out how it's going to work and who's going to pay for it, who's going to do what in each individual state. You're already late in getting that going. And they're not even ready with a enforcement agency. You know, we've told Chairman Schiller, we've told anybody who will listen, the RCI will help you any way we can, but, you know, do I think they're going to designate the RCI as the enforcement agency? I'm not going to go lobby for it. You know, we could do that if they wanted us to do it, but they needed to tell us soon if they wanted us to do that, because that takes a lot of planning. And there's nobody else out there who's got the expertise and the staff already on, you know,
right,
you know, in the building. Even USADA didn't have it.
Correct.
Okay, they needed to staff up. You needed to figure out, you know, there's a lot of good things in this bill, but the implementation of this has evolved into, there's really good people working on this.
That's the one thing about it that is.
But there might
hopeful.
Be too many lawyers.
There's always too many lawyers.
There might be too many lawyers, and I hate to say that. But when Charlie Shaler got up, the chairman of HISA got up at the racing symposium, you were there, mm-hmm. and he announced that they weren't going to, that the states were going to continue to collect samples after July 1st for the remainder of the year. Well, nobody talked to any of the states about that.
Nope.
And I had executive directors coming up to me saying, well, are they going to pay us for that? The states really don't have to do anything after July 1st. And do I think the states are going to continue? I think the practical nature is that they're not going to walk away.
No.
These are responsible, you know, agencies. But the there's a shift, and I don't think anybody fully appreciates, and even to this day, the enormity of what this potentially is. And the other thing is they passed the bill. Normally the federal government, when the federal government wants the states to run a program the way they want to dictate, the federal government puts money on the table. And they do it in Medicaid. They do it in a variety of federal programs. They say, listen, you do it our way, and we'll pick up 40% of your cost. You had a bill in a must-piece pass of legislation sponsored by the Speaker of the House and the majority leader at the time of the U.S. Senate, okay? It was attached as a Christmas ornament to what they call, I worked in D.C. for 10 years, okay? You get a bill like the COVID relief bill that everybody's going to vote for, and it's going to, we used to call it a Christmas tree. They hung a Christmas ornament, and HISA was a Christmas ornament on the Christmas tree. And it was a $1.5 trillion bill.
Right.
The federal government is throwing money out the window. And do you mean to tell me that Nancy Pelosi, Paul Tonko, Mitch McConnell couldn't find anything, $20, $30, $50 million for horse racing? They didn't give a dime. As the federal government is throwing money around, nothing. And that is the high-risk poker game everybody's in right now.
Hmm.
And that is called HISA.
Explain, Ed, and you've been on with me for 15 years. Explain again RCI and what its tentacles involve, and how it can be successfully adjoined. If this is going to go forward, pending legislation, what can RCI do? What areas can you comfortably commit to?
RCI, let's explain what RCI is.
Well, Racing Commissioners International.
RCI is an umbrella group of the government-sanctioned regulators, primarily in North America, but beyond North America. Some in the Caribbean, and we've got the Equestrian Club of Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, as a member. To my members, I say RCI is Alcoholics Anonymous for racing regulators. We all have the same problem. We lock ourselves in the room. We figure out how best to use it. And not every one commission has got the expertise on staff, but the expertise is in the network, and we help each other. You know, if you're in a particular state and you're working on a wagering rule, you know, you might not have the expertise on your commission. Well, they might have it in Texas. So we put the Texas person in the room. So we all help each other. And so what we do, you know, we develop the model rules. You know, if somebody just decided you wanted to have total uniformity, well, that's a one line in a federal bill. We incorporate the model rules by reference, and everybody's got to adhere to the model rules, and the state commissions don't have to rewrite them or tinker with them here or tinker with them there, and you'd have total uniformity.
Hmm.
We have advocated privately to the RMTC at one point that they become a lab purchasing cooperative. We wanted to have a high level discussion with the executive board of the RMTC about how the industry group and the regulatory network can complement each other and work, because they do a lot of good work over there, and there's things that they do. And the concept of having uniform testing, we thought, really required all the labs maybe to work for one boss. And then you could have the same screening limit in Arkansas as you have in Kentucky, or you have in New York or California. It was just one boss. So, you know, whether it be an investigation or an adjudication of a case, you know, you read some of the rules that the HISA had put on their website. if you had worked for a state racing commission as a hearing officer or a prosecutor, you were disqualified. You were disqualified for 2 years for being in a pool of hearing officers. You know, I have prosecutors who have never, ever, ever lost a racing case, including people like Rick Goodell, you know, who was with New York. He's not with them anymore. But he had to do that Lou Pena case where you had 1,600 drug violations. Everybody's focused on the labs. What about the auditing of the records? That's how the New York Gaming Commission got to Lou Pena. Okay? You know, so it seems to me that there's been an awful lot of emphasis on the PR of all of this, and we haven't gotten in the room. You know, the key people in the room and hammer out how this is going to work. But it's their prerogative who they want to let in that room. They certainly have not let us in that room, and they wouldn't let anybody observe from the RCI on behalf of the state racing commissions of the committee meetings. They shut everybody out.
They didn't let HBPA.
They didn't let and not even the industry. So the industry is going to lose a tremendous and we've made this point, and I'm hopeful that Lisa Lazarus and the board realize what's working and what's not working and what can work better. And if you can't, then you know, this is the industry is going to lose a tremendous amount of transparency that already. I have no idea what the budget's going to be. They put out a cost allocation rule that's pending at the FTC, where they told every state for every $1 million of the HISA budget how much the state is going to get assessed. Now that bill initially will go to the racing commission. If the state decides we're not paying the bill, then HISA is going to send it to the tracks. That's what's in the FTC proposal, which is fine. That's consistent with the statute. But we don't know. We don't know. Is their budget $10 million, $20 million, $50 million, $100 million? And the first budget is not going to have the biggest expense, which is the anti-doping program. The anti-doping program is the biggest expense of any individual state racing commission. And if the first bill is, we just need to know this. And the states are anxious because they have to plan. They've got people leaning on them from budget divisions and legislative committees. So what does your budget need to be? What is it? And they can't give them any answers. So that's why they got to get in the room with these individual states behind closed doors, stop having a PR agency booking, you know, executives and board members into interviews, put those people in the room.
Start the work.
So if I sound emotional.
No, well, everybody, you know, that's why everybody's,
you know,
emotional about it.
A lot of us lost a lot of sleep about this. And you're talking to an industry. You're talking, look at the inflation rate. When we started with HISA, inflation rate was like 1.6%. Look at it now. Look at what the price of oil is. Look at everybody who's running a farm. Look at everybody who's running a breeding operation or a racetrack. Okay? Well, what did oil close yesterday? $110 a gallon? And now we're importing from Russia now? We used to export. Now we're importing from Russia. Those prices are going to continue to go up, and then you're going to put HISA on top of that. There's a lot of good stuff in that bill, but this bill might be ripe for a technical correction by Congress because it was rushed in, it was hung on the Christmas tree like a Christmas ornament, and this industry cannot have major factions of the industry fighting in federal court for years. HISA's going to pass. They've told us they're going to pass those costs of whoever their law firm is, and they don't come cheap. Okay, they're not using or relying on the FTC lawyer in that case. Okay, they've got their own high-powered guns. That bill is supposedly going to work into the HISA budget and come back to the states and ultimately, or the racetracks or the industry. That's going to be included. That's what we've been told. So we'll see. But are you going to go for years like that, arguing up a case? You know, this end. I worked on Steve. I'll shut up.
It's fabulous.
You gave me the shot, so I'm going to unload. So I'm sorry. I worked for 10 years on Capitol Hill years ago. I have never in my life seen an industry walk through the halls of Congress fighting with itself. I've never seen an industry walk through the halls of Congress say, we're all screwed up. Never. You put your best foot forward. You go to Congress to get something that is going to help you, and you go in a united way. And we did. This industry didn't. And the best thing about the HISA bill is hopefully it was going to end all that, and the industry could unite. And I don't know what's going to happen in any of these court cases. You know, I'm not taking sides on any of it. Our attitude is my members enforce laws, we implement laws, we don't make laws. So somebody else makes laws. So that's where our heads are at. And I've got some members have joined different lawsuits and so forth. But this cannot, we need, I was asked the other day, what is it the most of the state racing commissions, what's their top priority, what do they want? You know what my answer was? I think it's the same answer for everybody in the industry. We want certainty. We want certainty. We can't be going like this.
No.
Pretty sobering.
Well, this has been any number of people, Alan Foreman and Eric, you know, other observers and tangential participants have been waving these flags. And, you know, Dick will smile because he loves the analogy. I like the Christmas ornament. My line, Ed, was it was like the night auditor at the Holiday Inn sliding the bill under your door at 2:30. Nobody, you know, there was no time to, you know, to make the kind of preliminary infrastructuring that was going to answer all of these questions. I mean, there's a reason you submit blueprints for approvals. You don't start building and then, you know, once you've dug the hole and poured some concrete, say, we should really from here, from this point forward, we really should lay out what we're going to do from here.
And let me ask you, you mentioned, and Dr. Daniels mentioned, as you were explaining your sides, there's some good things in this bill, but what are some of the things that you think are positive about
this? Well, I think you're going to get to
a
system of total uniformity. You're going to have common management of the tracks, of not the tracks, the labs, in terms of screening limits and so forth. You're going to increase the jurisdiction over the horse. The existing regulatory structure, the states have jurisdiction over the horse. It differs from state to state. In some states, they have to be on the grounds of a licensed facility. They can't be on a farm. They have no jurisdiction over the horse on the farm. They take jurisdiction over the horse after the first timed workout. Now, we think they should take jurisdiction over the horse from the minute that horse is registered to be a racehorse as a thoroughbred.
Todd Pletcher made that point right from the get-go. Yeah. He's been making that point for ages.
And we've made that point, and you would think I dropped a bomb on parts of the industry when I said that, because there's parts of the industry that are just not regulated. And we were concerned at the time about the misuse or overuse of bisphosphonate drugs and what the long-term effects on some of these horses might be, and where's that contributing to the level of catastrophic breakdowns. If you look at the doping testing, it might, you know, I'll preserve judgment, but I think what's my guess is when you look at the World Anti-Doping Agency statistics, you look at the USADA statistics and their interannual reports, what you'll see is the number of tests, the number of positives, or the percentage of clear samples is pretty much the same. So do I think they're going to catch more cheaters in horse racing? I think anybody can answer that. You know, everybody talks about these federal indictments. You know, they don't talk about the federal indictments that are occurring in other sports. I mean, they just got a guy for misbranding out of El Paso, Texas. You know, they don't talk about the federal indictments that resulted as a result of the State Racing Commission's working with the U.S. Attorney in Louisiana to go after the compounding labs. You think there was only one entity that was potentially going to be working with law enforcement. State Racing Commissions do that all the time. What they should have done in that bill is they should have created a seat in the federal law enforcement agencies, because it's been a problem when the Racing Commission takes something to a law enforcement agency and says, we've got something more serious here, getting their attention. It would be great to have an internal advocate through their bureaucracy to be able to get you involved. If you look at the indictments and the cases, the powers that were necessary to make those cases and get those convictions are not given to USADA or an enforcement agency or to HISA. It's the ability as a law enforcement agency to go in front of a judge and get a wiretap. State Racing Commissions don't have it. HISA's not going to have it. USADA doesn't have it. So, you know, but the uniformity, the consistency of the testing, the fact that you will end up with a multi-jurisdictional investigative entity, that has been needed. We've called for that. The increased jurisdiction over the horse is needed, and the greater monitoring over the health and of the care of those horses, so that you can maybe have an early warning system to identify horses that might not be suitable to be in a race because of some health condition. They may need time on the shelf. There's a lot of mechanisms in place to do that, and there's a, you know, when we analyzed the bill, we put out a report on the bill, and we said, fixing the kitchen by building an entire new house. And that's what they did.
Well, and that is very similar to the position that Alan has taken. That was, we didn't need a bulldozer here. We needed just some adjustments, and we needed some things that corrected. Got things on a better track in terms of things like the uniformity. You talk about the multi-jurisdictional agency. I had a wonderful conversation over Christmas, between Christmas and New Year's, with Paul Berube. And I asked Paul if he was interested in coming on and talking about TRPB's origins and the I don't want to call them glory years, but, you know, the years of very successful boots on the ground implementation of racetrack supervision and in some cases, you know, prosecution, etc. Why is this not being taken advantage of? Why do we not have TRPB to the level that we did at one time? And can it be reestablished?
Well, and I think they're put aside the names of organizations, because organizations have evolved, but there is a need. For a multi-jurisdictional investigative entity, and the HISA bill does provide for that, has regulatory authority. The TRPB never had regulatory authority, but they cooperated in most jurisdictions with the regulators, and they would develop a case. And sometimes
state police and so forth.
Yeah, but you go from the private realm into the government realm, and there's things, the police agencies, state police, FBI, anybody who walks around and says they know what's going to happen in a law enforcement investigation is speculating, including myself. That's a very, and I've been part of assisting, you know, major federal investigations into horse racing matters. And I can't tell you what's going to happen, when indictments are coming, if their indictments are coming, who's going to be indicted, who they're looking at. I know who they might ask me about, but I don't talk about that. And they're never going to talk about that. That's why when you go to a law enforcement agency, they never confirm or deny whether there's investigation. You go to a racing commission, they say the same darn thing.
Which, in fact, maybe you could even fold in what transpired here with the KHRC and how they've had to make a rule change so that they can publicly acknowledge everything that went on with the positive call involving Medina Spirit and the Derby. They had to make an adjustment to their own internal mechanisms. Right. That's one of the revelations here over the past year.
Well, I mean, you know, there's internal there's internal documents that are part of an investigation. Investigatory files are usually, and then it not public in any level of law enforcement or regulatory enforcement. When you bring the charge, all your supporting evidence becomes public. If there's an appeal, it all becomes public because discovery puts it into the court record. So, you know, I don't want to get into the weeds about a single commission's rules on that stuff. But for instance, the rules that HISA posted on the medication stuff, it was not a certainty that the Medina Spirit positive in the Derby would have been known. It's possible we could have gone all of these months and never known about it. If Baffert didn't announce it, we wouldn't have known.
Well, and you also do have that mechanism of purses not being
well. The minute you freeze everything and you issue a preliminary ruling, you've got to put a ruling to freeze purses. You know that becomes a matter of public knowledge. Now the states are still in control of the purses. So again, this has to be figured out how this is all going to complement each other. You know, HISA doesn't freeze purses.
There's no mechanism for them to.
They got to negotiate. They got to get in the room. I can't sit. You know, somebody's got to get in the room, and you don't make that. Don't do that unilaterally. it's time for everybody to roll up their sleeves and figure out how this is going to work.
Clock's ticking, isn't it?
It's always ticking.
Right.
But it's ticking for everybody.
Yeah. Listen, somebody said to me, I'm almost reluctant to say this, somebody said this to me, this is such a mess. He says that maybe the best thing that could happen is if Putin does drop a nuclear bomb.
Oh,
I said, I'm not ready to go there. Yeah. It's, you know, it's a great sport, and there's a lot of great people in it, and... you know, you go to these different meetings, like the HBPA meeting. You know, everybody wants the same thing. Everybody wants safe horses. Everybody wants honest contests, period. And, you know, there are challenges. You know, I know the racing commissions haven't been perfect. I don't think USADA's perfect either. I don't think anybody's perfect. You know, can we all do a better job? Yeah. And that's what the HISA thing was kind of about. But, you know, in getting to do a better job, if you make a bigger mess, then... you know, maybe you got to go back to the drawing board and rethink it. So, that's who knows how this is going to play out. We're just going to try to help everybody as best we can, and you know, we've told them you can knock on our door and you tell us what you need us to do, and we'll try to do it for you.
Well, there's also, it's funny you say that, knock on the door, and the one problem that we've got is that there's entities and interests in the game that. Essentially painted everybody with this same broad brush of ineptitude and malfeasance and every other, you know, negative you could think of. And so, you know, basically in inviting this initiative at the same time, they in the establishing of this, it was made to... The industry was made to look like they were, you know, inept, that they can't do anything for ourselves. And so from that standpoint, these outsiders, and when we say outsiders, if we're talking about Lisa Lazarus and Charlie Sheeler, just starting with them, I mean, they are eminently qualified for this kind of a role and accomplished people that I think we can be very confident in, but they've been sold this bill of goods that this is a bunch of half-wits and drug-addled, reliant, you know, cheaters, and that did nobody any good. I mean, what was the need to portray the industry like this when you could have, like you just said, gone forward and asked as a uniform group, as an entity, you know, help us, you know, tie these loose ends together, you know, to improve the game as a whole, the industry as a whole.
Steve, I can't answer.
No,
I can't answer. You know, I can't answer why people do things.
The Saul Alinsky approach. You demonize your opponent. You're not trying to fix it. You're trying to destroy it. It's about power. It's not about fixing it. If it's about fixing it, we would have fixed it. is about power. And they've been on this power trip. They've been using the bulldozer on everything, literally, metaphorically. That's been the strategy on every single issue that's come up. So when it happens over and over again, it's pretty obvious what the strategy is. Demonize everyone who disagrees with you. You know, we're the knuckle draggers that are, you know, addicted to Lasix and clenbuterol and whatever else they're going to accuse us of. And I tell people, step back just for a second. The federal government had been involved on another case, got kind of steered over to this case. Jeff Gural put up money, and somehow Five Stones gets brought into the conversation. And the main effort was a raid on a low-level standardbred training center in the Catskills in New York. I mean, they didn't even catch any main standardbred trainers. And the only ones that they caught in the thoroughbred world just happened to be in New Jersey and in this, under this umbrella of influence where many of these bad actors were operating, including the one guy was a bad actor and the other guy hasn't gone to trial yet. But it was just so they've been pushing this, and no matter how many things pop up, like missing deadlines and not working with the ground. I remember when Violet got up when Paul Tonko made this introduction at the opening board in August. 4 years ago? Rick Violet he never talked to us. And he was told, he was told they did. So he had no idea that he's a liberal Democrat, and he's sponsoring a bill that never talked to labor. He's not the person that's going to be in that role. But they put him in that role because he believed what they told him. Now, your point perfect with Lisa, Chuck, qualified, yes. But they're starting out with two. They've been told 2 + 2 = 5.
Well, and they lost the month they had this nominating committee go through the charade, and I'm going to call it a charade, of considering people to be appointed to the boards and committees. And I say it was a charade because I was asked, to recommend some names by, and I won't mention the individual, but he was associated with one of the main proponent organizations of that got the bill through. And so I offered up some names of people that I thought, because it would qualify for independent seats, but who had a history of a well-respected history on the regulatory side, who would understand the concepts of the regulations that the HISA was responsible for, be independent enough to be independent. That's really a stupid way to say that, isn't it, Steve?
That's all right.
But my point is, none of those people were even called or interviewed. Hmm. And they were high-level people, including people who had advocated for federal legislation, weren't even spoken to. And then they come out with a list, and, you know, there's all sorts of great names, but there's a lot of familiar names on that list. And I kind of said, if you're going to come out with that list, you didn't need 4 months to go through a charade. You know, you have an implementation deadline. You lost 4 valuable months. I spent an hour and a half on the phone with the co-chair, the dean of University of Kentucky School of Agriculture. I spent an hour and a half, and I just told her the sensitivities, the political sensitivities, the regional sensitivities, the type of experience where I sat working with commissions and rulemakings and enforcement, you know, of this area. I just wasted my time that hour and a half. I mean, I lovely lady, you know. I went to the Jockey Club dinner. I went to say hi to her. She couldn't even make eye contact. You know, it was interesting. It's been an interesting journey.
Ed Martin, everybody, RCI.
The man everybody hates.
No!
That's not true. No. Not at all.
Depends on the day, Steve.
Well, listen, there's...
Well, you were in Washington.
that's a long time ago, and I
I love it.
I got out of the swamp.
Ed, I appreciate it as always.
Anytime.
Always valuable. Always time well spent. No doubt about it.
It's always good to see you.
Absolutely.
It's always good to see you guys. So, well, you know,
the whether it's here at
especially
the symposium.
Dick.
Well, Dick is
he's everywhere.
Dick is
he was in the grocery store one day. I was
Saratoga.
Going in to get grocery stores, Price Chopper in Malta, and out walked Dick Powell. You know, I mean, I felt like asking for an autograph. I think I asked him for a pick in the third. But
That too.
Even less important. But yeah, Ed and I run into each other.
I rarely.
And on the contrary, every time I go to Tucson, I give you a call, and you're never there. So actually, I don't think we've only met a few times over the past 20 years ever. But I do have something to talk to you about, which I will talk to you about later.
Yeah. I live in Tucson.
I know. That's what I got.
Well,
the
you know, I'm going around to these meetings.
I talk to Martin. You know, Martin Panzer. He goes, just call Ed. He's in town.
Well, you split time though, right? Do you not?
Yeah. We're still summer in Saratoga.
Saratoga. Yeah.
We're gonna miss the meet. Well, you kidding?
Exactly. How many months? How many months do you spend in Saratoga?
Depends on the year. Depends on the year, and depends on how hot it gets.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah, when you blow out.
I got a great house at Saratoga if you want one.
Well.
Yeah, who's thinking of it?
Really? All right.
Okay, see. Thank
Ed
you.
Ed Martin, everybody. Right, Ed, always valuable to get Ed's, you know, Ed like Dick in a lot of ways in terms of an institutional knowledge and experience that just, you know, you can't conjure that up.
It's... When you've been around, and I have a pretty good memory and can place things in context. Some people can remember A happened, but I can remember A happened because B, C, and D were lined up. But, you know, just stuff like that. So then with people like Ed and other people, then it kind of reinforces the background knowledge and everything. So that's always a huge help.
The opportunity probably here at the bottom of the hour. Let's do this. We've got a few different things. I got to get to Sid, but we're also going to have a window with Pat Cummings and with Adam Koenig. He has a meeting, I know, at 11. He's got a committee, some sort of a committee thing. So I think let's take, Casey, let's take the break right here. And we'll come back for the second half, and that'll include Adam Koenig from Northern Kentucky, and Pat, and I'll get to Sid, and then later with Dick. Dick is going to hang and as well, and then we've got an interesting opportunity for later that I think people will really enjoy because we're going to get a chance to talk about fixed odds and get sort of a different perspective on the fixed odds story. So let's take our only break of the morning. We'll come right back to Hot Springs and the Oaklawn Racing Casino Resort Hotel with a lot more. Stay with us.
Over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at pabred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com.